All right, Dan, we'll just start doing this in 10 seconds.
Hello?
Hey there, everybody. I'm Dean Compton. You are listening to the first edition of the Unspoken Decade podcast. We got a great guest for you today. Dan Juergens has taken some time out of his busy schedule to talk to us about the seminal event Zero Hour from the 1990s. Dan, how are you doing today?
How about you, Dean?
I'm doing pretty well. And you know what? If I wasn't doing well and complained about it, wouldn't do no good anyway.
Exactly right.
Dan, first off, I want to thank you for all your hard work on this event and everything else you've done. Tell us a little bit about what you got going on now so that people can go out and buy those comics.
Okay, right now I am one of the four writers, along with Brian Azzarello, Keith Giffen, and Jeff Lemire on DC's weekly Futures End, which is kind of setting up sort of a definitive story in the DC universe, and also the writer on Aquaman and the Others.
Awesome, awesome. I've really enjoyed your Aquaman, by the way.
Well, thanks. And in addition to all of that, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard about the Convergence event coming up in April and May. I'm the writer of Convergence Zero, writing both Superman and Booster Gold Convergence specials, so all sorts of stuff coming up.
That sounds awesome, man. I'll definitely be picking that stuff up. And like I said, you know, the Unspoken Decade, it's really the only 90s comic book website out there, because for whatever reason, Dan, everyone hates the 90s except me and the people who participated in creating the great comic books of the 90s. I'm not sure why you get such a bad rep, but I'm doing my best to, you know, take that tarnish off. And one of the things that I point to people when it comes to 90s comic books, when they say they're, you know, not good or, you know, too flashy or anything, I always point to Zero Hour as a really good event that had a lot of, you know, really neat little moments as well, that it kind of all converged to make a, you know, a really cool story that, you know, sort of reset the DC universe, not unlike, I guess, what Marvel's doing now.
I don't know. I really can't speak to what Marvel is doing now because I'm not working on it. Yeah, I certainly know what Zero Hour was. I know what its intent was. And would also have to say, you know, it's interesting. What the fans I interact with, I think there is tremendous love out there for the 90s and the stuff that was done. And I think some of that is because it was so much fun. There was this attitude that we could really push the limits and tell some really big stories, and people remember it, I think, quite fondly.
What I find, you know, having been a teenager in the 90s, you know, I love it and remember it quite fondly, but it seems like the people who were my mentors in comic books, you know, the guys who are 5-7 years older than me, they're not such big fans of the era. But, you know, it's just this thing, you know, you get older, things change, and, you know, I don't like those changes. Imagine that, comic book fans not liking changes.
Well, yeah, and you know, the other part of it is, quite frankly, I think back then, if you were a teenager, we were probably producing a product that was more friendly to teenagers than the overall product that we're producing right now. So, you know, maybe that's part of it as well.
No, absolutely. I think that's a great point, that, you know, the 90s definitely produced great teen-centric comics, and not just the Image stuff, but, you know, even stuff over at DC like Damage or Your Teen Titans or, you know, Marvel, just lots of stuff. But we got a lot to cover. I know you got a, you know, busy schedule, a lot of things to do. So
sure.
tell me a little bit about the genesis of Zero Hour. Is this something that, you know, the company came to you and wanted you to do, or is this a story that you kind of had percolated in your head that then you said, hey, we could do this story and possibly straighten out some of the continuity blips that have been occurring?
Well, one of the things that had happened is, you know, a number of years had passed since Crisis on Infinite Earths, and one of the things we were ending up with prior to Zero Hour was a DC universe of characters that were aging very, very rapidly. In Green Arrow, for example, we were seeing Oliver Queen celebrate his 44th and 45th birthdays. I mean, they were actually saying, you know, happy 44th birthday, Oliver Queen. In Green Lantern, all of a sudden, Hal Jordan was getting older, and he had the gray hair at his temples and everything else. And
yeah, he went Mr. Fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, all you had to do was look at it and see that somehow, almost overnight, those characters had aged are. So at the same time, the Justice Society characters were aging as well. So if you start to extrapolate some of the numbers, you know, we're on the verge of being 50 years past the end of World War II. And as you started to do the simple math of JSA characters in World War II and DC characters emerging when they did, and the there were just too many age conflicts to start to overcome. So I went to DC and I said, look, I have this idea. Here's something we can do, and we can kind of start to correct some of this and make it work and get it back where it needs to be. At the same time, they had been loosely kicking around the idea with Casey Carlson, who was an editor on staff at that point. And they put us together and said, why don't you guys see if there's something that can make these two general ideas come together, and the result was Zero Hour.
Yeah, and speaking of the crisis, like you said, it had been some time since the Crisis on Infinite Earths, and this was called Crisis in Time. I'm assuming that that was done by design to kind of tie its lineage to the historic DC crises, Crisis on Earth 1 and Earth 2.
Absolutely.
And that's also a question that I have from an email about the, you know, the treatment of Flash in Zero Hour. You're kind of hearkening back, having that moment with the Flash again. It seemed to me like here's our Flash moment to compare to the Flash moments of Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah, we really did. There's something about Flash and crossovers.
Right.
That kind of a combination. And in fact, we even used that in issue zero of Future's End, where we had Barry Allen running around with a beard and 35 years in the future. And of course, he ended up dying by about, what, page 3 or 4. So, yeah, there's every recognition out there that when it comes to crises and, you know, big universal spanning problems, the Flash has to be front and center.
You mentioned, too, the aging of Green Arrow. Like you said, he had celebrated his 44th and 45th birthday in his own titles. But Zero Hour also kind of brought him back to mainstream DC continuity. I mean, it's not like he wasn't part of the DC universe, but he mostly just kind of hung out with Batman and The Question here and yon, and Black Canary, obviously. Were you wanting to get Green Arrow back into the swing of things as far as DC goes, or was that something that the company had in mind?
Well, I had, prior to working on Zero Hour, I had actually been drawing Green Arrow for a couple of years as Mike Rowe was writing it. And I think he had gotten to the point where his connection to the DCU overall was tangential at best. Obviously, he had a relationship with Black Canary. We actually had him meet the Warlord, Travis Morgan, at one point. But it's not like the way he was written as part of Longbow Hunters and everything that he was, you know, part of the Justice League so much anymore. So, yeah, part of this was the idea that we can blend him back in with the DCU, which is where I kind of think fans were ready for him to be. And I always look at it this way, which is when Mike Grell did Longbow Hunters and everything, I think at that time, that's sort of what Green Arrow needed. But then when you get down the road a few years, I think fans were ready for him to kind of come back to the DCU overall.
Yeah, I'm a big Green Arrow guy. He's my second favorite superhero, and I was certainly interested to see him, you know, interacting with guys like the Justice League, because I had some Bronze Age comics where he did, and he was always better as the everyman than Batman, if you ask me. You know, even though he used to be rich, he was still more of a man of the street.
Right, right. And he wasn't as obsessed, so there was a touch of humanity to him that I think Batman generally lacked.
Yeah, I totally agree. And spoiler alert, people, these comics are 20 years old. So if you don't know this about the big bad guy, I apologize for breaking it to you here. But the Green Arrow, you know, and his relationship with Hal Jordan, who winds up being Parallax here in Zero Hour, comes to play later on. Were you setting this up, like, during the reign of the Supermen when, you know, obviously you were working on the Superman titles at the same time. Did you have this in mind even then when we first saw Coast City get destroyed?
No, actually, when I first suggested the idea of destroying a city, I wanted to use Central City. And the Flash guy said no. So after that, we moved on to Coast City. You know, Green Lantern, as a franchise, was sort of struggling at that point. So they said, well, yeah, by all means, let's go for it. And And independently of that, then Mike Carlin, who was Superman editor, and Kevin Dooley, who was the Green Lantern editor, got together and said, you know, we can use this as a catalyst for some substantial changes with Hell. And that's where they went out and started to put that together and brought Ron Mars in to do the book and all that kind of stuff. At the same time, I knew those conversations were taking place. I knew they were going to have him become, you know, essentially something beyond as a villain that would later become Parallax. And as all that was coming together, I said, hey, wait a minute. There's a way we can use him in Zero Hour. And so it all started to blend together.
Was it your idea to use Hank Hall as Extant?
More or less, yeah. I wanted someone who could kind of touch back to some previous type appearances in the DCU, and Hank was a logical choice at that point.
Right on. I mean, it was awesome to see him there because it was kind of a surprise, which is the complete antithesis of what had happened with, you know, Armageddon 2001 with Captain Atom being leaked as, you know, Monarch.
Right.
Talk to me a little bit about how it gets set up, where all the individual crossovers into the, you know, the ongoing DC titles happened. I know you worked on one where Superman's parents came back from Krypton, but I wonder how, when you do an event of this magnitude, how, if there, or if there, even if there's any work with the various titles, because this was everywhere from, you know, Batman to Anima.
Right, and I think it's important to know what the scope of the overall project was at that time. And some of that was, anytime, you know, companies were doing crossovers, the goal was always to, I think, launch new books out of the crossover. What we also decided to do at Zero Hour is kind of relaunch the line a little bit at the same time. So every single book in the line got an issue zero. And the idea was, look, you know, and this is kind of how we took it to the writers and made them understand what we were going for here, which is this. This is going to be an issue zero. You're going to get much higher sales on this one than you do your typical books. This is an issue for you to tell a story about why your character or characters do what they do, who they are, who their villains are, how they interact, set something up going forward, et cetera, et cetera. It is your chance to reintroduce your characters to the reading audience and move on from there. And that's really what all those issue zeros were designed to be. And in the case of someone like, say, Superman or Batman, where they were obviously going to have more than one, at that point, you know, it was, what can you say with each individual issue? And so with Superman, yeah, I kind of focused on his parents.
Yeah, it's a really cool crossover in that you have lots of neat little moments like that in the individual issues. Batgirl's return, Alpha Centurion in Superman titles. And I just did a blog about Superman, the Man of Steel, where he meets seemingly every Batman that's ever existed. And these things were handled with aplomb. I mean, you guys did a really great job.
Yeah, thank you.
I just appreciate people's hard work. I don't think people get thanked for their hard work enough, Dan.
Well, I think that's probably true in every walk of life.
Exactly. I thank my girlfriend for her hard work when she does, like, she cooks some hamburgers. I'm like, thanks. She's like, wasn't a big deal, but that's just how I am. So I appreciate the attention to nuance. Every one of those single, you know, those individual crossover books kind of felt like a fun event in and of themselves, but they also didn't take anything away. Like, if you only read the issue you did where Kal-El's parents returned from Krypton, you didn't miss anything. You know, it's not like you lost out, you know, and you had to buy the next one.
And that was actually very intentional. The whole idea was that readers could get the overall story of Zero Hour in the miniseries itself. After that, we certainly hope they'd pick everything up and give it a look, but it wasn't an absolute necessity. I think there were still plenty of reasons to do so, and certainly new characters that were introduced and launched as part of this, so it all worked out well.
And you also talked about launching new books at a zero hour, and a few new books did come. One of them, I think the criminally underrated Primal Force, which you were setting up in the zero hour miniseries itself. What did you know about how that book was coming together? Because, you know, it involved Dr. Mist, the Red Tornado, Jack-O-Lantern, guys that were like, I mean, at that time, kind of on the periphery of the periphery, you know? I mean, they were about as far away from the center as you could get.
Right, exactly. In a case like that, once it became known that we were going to do Zero Hour as a project, we started to say, okay, what else can we do with it? What else can we launch out of it? And, you know, we looked at some of the things that were just in the office as far as stuff that had been pitched, various ideas. There were a couple there that looked like they might work out with it pretty well, and there were some projects that DC wanted to do. One of those was Primal Force. So at that point, I sat down with it, and you know, the pitch, if you will, and the outline, and took a look and said, how can I start to bleed this into the mini? So that was something that generally existed or came into existence while I was doing Zero Hour, and then I just took what the writer had already started to assemble and figured a way to put it into the series.
There's a lot of, you know, a lot of talk of various continuity issues and things that, you know, anomalies, things that didn't make sense within the DC universe to a certain degree, to as much sense as a superhero universe can ever make. But what did you think was, like, the biggest aberration that you had to correct or at least, you know, address with Zero Hour?
Oh, boy. Probably Hawkman. I think Hawkman is the one that, at that point, probably just needed explanation and streamlining, because we had seen so many different versions of Hawkman by that point already. You know, you had the Egyptian God version, you had the guy from Thanagar, you had sort of everything in between, and it was getting to the point where I kind of say that if it takes you more than a sentence to explain a character's origin, you've really messed up the character. So that was the case with Hawkman, and he was certainly one we wanted to straighten out. Obviously, once Superman had been redone, the Legion was a problem as well, because even though you had the pocket universe explanation, that left too many gaps open as well. And so I think the other one was Legion that needed to be addressed.
And you addressed it very well, you know, utilizing the Time Trapper. I believe even, you know, the pocket universe was kind of mentioned here and yon. And I think in the Superboy comic, actually, it was the new rad Superboy versus Superboy, you know, very reminiscent of the Superboy from the pocket dimension. And I'm a big fan of that era of the Legion. Again, you know, that's my Legion as far as I'm concerned, you know, as the ones that I, when I was in my golden age, if you will, I grew up reading. What, you know, when it comes to the Legion, I was stymied getting into it, you know, because there was Legionnaires, Legion of Superheroes, all kinds of different reboots and the like. I understand Hawkman's the biggest problem, but was it important to you to kind of get the Legion going as well? Because I think they're one of the neatest aspects of the DC universe. I mean, they emerge in an era when, like, everything's, you know, glum in the real world. Everybody fears atomic war, but here are these kids from the future with superpowers making sure everything's okay.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's true because, you know, a few years earlier, the Legion had been a remarkably good seller for DC, and has had the Titans. And I think as part of this, yeah, we wanted to find a way to make the Legion work a little better again, kind of get it back on the rails, because really, more than any other property at DC, when John Byrne redid Superman, and, you know, not that this was a mistake or anything, but the Legion is a book that suffered as a part of that, just because, you know, Superboy was eliminated. And once you did that, that messed with Legion in a big way.
Yeah, they didn't really have a reason to exist.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and I think in a way DC has struggled with that ever since, which is how can we make the Legion work when that's the overall issue.
Yeah, it does seem like they've kind of struggled with that ever since. But, you know, hopefully it'll all get straightened out. I'm a big Legion guy, big Superboy guy. So, you know, I'm sure all you smart, creative folks will figure it out, Dan.
We'll work on it, yeah.
You mentioned the Justice Society of America earlier. And the JSA essentially, you know, gets obliterated in 0 Hour. Most of them are, you know, dead or having heart attacks or are aged to their proper age, with the exception of Alan Scott, the Golden Age Green Lantern. And this, I know this caused some schisms at the time with various fans who had been, you know, big supporters of the Len Strzewski, Mike Parabek Justice Society of America. And I wonder if you heard any flack about that, or did you, you know, how, you know, what were your feelings on doing that to the Justice Society in that era? Because I did an interview with Len Strzewski a few months back, and he maintains that that was a political decision, and that, you know, the sales were fine. There was no need to have gotten rid of the Justice Society from a sales standpoint.
Well, the reality is that, and yeah, I agree with Len. Pretty much on what he said. I don't think that Justice Society was canceled for any sales reason. I think it had more to do with what was the image that DC wanted to have for its characters overall. And in that case, you know, the Justice Society was gone before we even did 0 Hour. Either that or at least the decision had been made for it to go, but I think it was gone even before we did it. And part of it, it just got back to, if you looked at the concept of the Justice Society, if they were going to have fought in World War II, and they were aging to the rate they were, and some of that was driven by the problems with PC Silver Age characters that were aging so much, that we started to get this real paradox and this problem of ages of the characters. So I think overall there was an idea that said, you know, we have to deal with this overall issue of age with the characters, where they are, how they function, etc.
You know, absolutely. I totally understand. Justice Society is my favorite super team of all time, but I thought they went out very nobly, you know, and I thought that they, you stayed true to the characters, even if a lot of them, you know, were afflicted by various deleterious, you know, events. You really got across the, you know, not just the Justice Society, Dan, but kind of, you know, the way we feel about the men and women of that generation.
Right. Tried to.
Yeah, I think you did a good job, and this is my podcast, so my opinion is one that matters.
Okay, I'll roll with that.
No. You know, everybody's entitled to an opinion, obviously. I'm sure I'll get a bunch of comments about that one right there. But I also wanted to talk to you about a little moment in 0 Hour, which is that, you know, Batman, he gets zapped by one of those entropy fissures, and he's not one of the guys at the end of the, you know, series that winds up saving the day. And I thought it was really awesome, because it really demonstrated the, you know, a whole anything can happen kind of vibe. You figure the superheroes are going to save the day, but, you know, with Batman being gone, it kind of heightened that, you know, suspense of disbelief, if you will. Was that a decision that you made on purpose, or did that just kind of happen? Because if you look at other events, you know, no matter, you know, Batman's front and center at the end of the story as a general rule.
Right. No, it was intentional. In fact, as we put together the end of the book, the decisions as to who were going to, who would be there, were, those decisions were really carefully considered. I mean, each and every person who was there was considered and placed there for a specific reason, to have a specific role as part of the end of the story. It's also worth noting that at that time, you know, Batman's connection even to the Justice League as a whole was somewhat tenuous at best. So I think we pretty much all felt that it really fit with the way things had to work out.
And no, I completely agree. I thought it worked out really awesome. And it is really cool how when you read that story, you can tell that everybody who winds up saved by Wave Rider and the Linear Men, who get to see, you know, time reborn, and they wind up saving the day, everybody does fulfill a specific purpose. And I find that can be something lacking sometimes in these big events, Dan, where you wind up with a bunch of guys, you know, standing around. And if you got George Perez drawing them, I mean, that's great. But otherwise, sometimes people just kind of stand around.
Sure.
the Atom gets de-aged in this in Zero Hour, and that's a springboard into a book you mentioned earlier, Teen Titans, that you worked on. How long had you been, you know, trying to do this Teen Titans book, and was that something that you, I mean, obviously you were trying to springboard it out of Zero Hour, but was that something that, you know, you and DC have been talking about for a little bit?
Actually, when I did Zero Hour, no, we weren't looking at the Titans yet. That was something that came along later. It wasn't even a gleam in my eye when I did Zero Hour. It was farther down the road than that. It was going to happen a couple years later, and it wasn't even at that point anything we had talked about.
Ah, I got my notes messed up then. My all apologies, everyone. But, you know, the Atom being de-aged, I mean, that was kind of, it was kind of a surreal situation, because the Atom, I said this to a friend of mine once, he's kind of a deus ex machina in the DC universe, not unlike Doctor Strange can be sometimes in the Marvel universe, in that he shows up and he uses these smart, weird physics tactics to save, you know, any kind of crisis. And once he was de-aged, you know, I mean, I thought it was neat to watch him have to grow again, you know?
Right, right. And really, as part of that, the idea was there was a fairly strong current of thought at DC that wanted to see a couple of characters of great importance somehow, you know, and meaning die as part of this. And one of the things that we were getting asked to consider is actually having the Atom die. I didn't want to do that, so we talked about different ideas, and that's where we came up with the idea of turning back the clock for Ray Palmer. If we had not done that, he would not have emerged from Zero Hour alive. So there you go.
Wow. Well, I'm glad he emerged alive, because I'm a big Ray Palmer guy.
Yeah.
Zero Hour 2 kind of, you know, we talked about how it sprung forth new books, but it was also kind of the first time we got to see several of the young guns of the DC universe at that time start to play an important role. I think sometimes people forget that there, you know, not necessarily a youth movement at DC at the time, but there was an emphasis on younger characters like Damage, Ray, Impulse, Anima, and you got to see all these characters, in particular, you know, Damage and Ray, do some really important stuff in Zero Hour, and I'm assuming that was also by design, you know, that you guys wanted to show these characters, these younger characters, to what, again, as we noted earlier, was a young audience.
Yeah, and actually, you did have a pick right the first time. There was a youth movement at DC in terms of its characters, and that has everything to do with the age we had pushed the Silver Age characters to. And then you start asking, okay, so you've got the Ray as part of this story. Well, why was the Ray in Justice League and not the Teen Titans, et cetera, et cetera? That's where things kind of had gotten messed up. But yeah, there was an effort to use Ray, and most notably of all those characters, Damage, as part of the solution. Because, you know, when you do that, it elevates their profile. You know, unfortunately, it didn't stick for long anyway, but we made every attempt to do it. But, yeah, in a way, obviously, those characters fit into the theme of age overall in the DCU.
One of the things about the DCU that I've always loved, and I think that some of these younger characters like Ray or Impulse and even Damage demonstrate, is that the feeling of legacy. And I, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but Zero Hour, when it got rid of the JSA, and then we see these younger, you know, these younger guys step up and save the day alongside Superman and some stalwarts, obviously. I think that, you know, I don't know if you meant this, but subtextually to me, it was kind of a reaffirming of DC as the legacy company. Even if the older heroes are gone, that torch will be passed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Tell me about the big moment at the end of Zero Hour. And again, if you haven't read it, I'm very sorry to spoil a 20-year-old comic book for you. But the big event at the end, Green Arrow versus Green Lantern Parallax, and it's laid out beautifully, and it's so tense. And if you know the history between the characters, it just hits you right at the heart. Even as like a 15-year-old who, you know, hadn't really read the Neil Adams, Denny O'Neil stuff, but knew it existed, it still hit me really hard.
Yeah, and obviously there is a connection between those characters that we really wanted to play on, and they absolutely had to be part of. If you're going to have Hal Jordan as Parallax be part of the overall story and basically the guy who was making all of this happen, I think to have a good ending, you had to have Oliver be part of the solution. And it had to work that way, and I'm really kind of happy with the way it came out. I thought it was quite effective.
Indeed it was. What would you say, when it came to, you know, doing Zero Hour, what would you say was the most difficult aspect in regards to it? You know, I'm sure there was a lot of, you know, scheduling issues and getting editors on the same page and that kind of thing. But maybe there was something that was more difficult that I'm not sitting here thinking of.
Well, I think, any time you get into any kind of a massive line-wide crossover, what gets difficult really are the overall logistics, and it is everything that happens right from square one. It's trying to figure out a way, you know, if there are 40, 50 books in the line, to make everything work out with what you have. It's trying to be fair to all the characters, because, yeah, it would have been easy to write a story for me at that time in which Superman was the star of the book, for example. It is, it's really trying to be as even-handed as possible. It's making contact with all the other writers to find out exactly what it is that they're doing, so you can be fair to what they want to have happen in their books, where they want their characters to go, and also trying to get guys on board and just say, look, here's an opportunity for you. Here's where you can go with your book if you want to do so. If there's anything you don't like about your book right now, you have the chance to fix it. We're giving you the means to repair this character somehow if you want to take advantage of it. So it's all of that. In many ways, it really is all about the overall logistics of trying to get it all put together and really make it, especially when it's going to ship every week like Zero Hour did.
Right. Not only did it ship every week, but it counted down, which, you know, I don't know that I had seen a comic book do that before. Was that your idea?
That was not my idea. That I don't know who thought of that for sure. I think it kind of came from marketing, but I'm not 100% sure. But that one was not my idea. It was a great idea.
Yeah, it made it seem a lot more important somehow. It's weird. It's the little things sometimes that, you know, put something over the edge.
Right.
Is there anything, you know, looking back as far as the issues you tried to address that, you know, that you wish you had done better, or maybe even an issue that you didn't address that you wish you had looked at?
Oh, I don't know that it would be fair to get into that this time. There were some cases where, you know, character X, for example, I probably thought a different solution might have been more suitable. But if that particular writer didn't want to go that way, he was the individual doing the book at the time, and it was his prerogative to make that call. One of the things, for example, that I had pitched was coming out of Zero Hour with two Earths to get back to Earth 1 and Earth 2, put the Justice Society on Earth 2, where it's about somewhere between 1945 in 1965, and if they want to still be fighting World War II there, that's great. We'll set something up like that. If not, you know, maybe it's 1965, but it takes them, it was a way to have them be much closer age-wise to the characters, DC Silver Age characters, something like that. I still think that is something that could have worked out fairly well. It was just a time where they decided that wasn't the solution they wanted to embrace.
Tell me about the research and who worked on the really cool timeline that wraps the whole thing up in Zero Hour number zero. It's a big fold-out cover that I read that comic so much that cover wound up folded, that cover wound up falling off. So it just became a poster then.
Sure. We knew that as real early in the game, we knew this. And it was this, that when we were done, we wanted to erase all the questions about where things were in the DC universe and how they fit by having that very kind of timeline. And so, I mean, that was, and that's weird because you don't often decide that you know, 8 months later, you're going to produce something like that and actually think that far through. But we knew we wanted to have a poster, a timeline, a something right from day one. So even as we were pulling the series together, Casey Carlson and I would talk about different ideas of what would slot where. At the same time, he was working with other people in the office. I know, I think Bob Greenberger, who was on staff at that point, was very involved in trying to pull it all together. And then we kind of, you know, sit down and talk and say, okay, how exactly is this going to fit? What are we going to show? Where are these guys going to slot in on that timeline? And, you know, I still think it was one of the best ideas we ever had, which was to produce that. I think the fact that we actually cut it in print and it made as much sense as it did is fantastic, because anytime you do something like that, you're bound to have a fair amount of disagreement. And it felt really, really well. And quite honestly, I think it's something that could be used today. Let me rephrase that. I'd say that DC could use today as a new version of it.
Yeah, kind of a guideline to, you know, put everything in its place so that somebody could just look at it real quick and see how everything fits together.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for all the frustration that is out there on the part of writers insofar as continuity goes, and it's a legitimate frustration, fans love that kind of stuff. And ultimately it works out because you find yourself as a writer appreciating the fact that you have something like that you can refer to.
Well, what final thoughts do you have on Zero Hour? I mean, looking back at it 20 years later, I mean, I know it's been a while, but you know, I'm sure you know you have some final thoughts now. Looking back, you know, I'm sure you looked at it a little bit when you found out we were going to, you know, do this interview. So, what do you think about it now? Are you satisfied overall?
Yeah, I am. If you look at back at that time, if you consider the realities of where we were on everything, the realities of where DC was, the realities of what it was going to take to produce a project of that magnitude that was going to be written and drawn by one guy. You know, we live in a world now where you can barely find somebody to draw three issues in a row of something on a monthly basis to get, you know, we produced those five issues, that came out boom, 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 5 weeks in a row. I also wrote and drew the Superman issue that was Zero issue that was done along with that. And you kind of appreciate, I mean, it ends up being a battle in and of itself just to get that done. It's a tremendous effort to take something like that on. And to this day, I haven't seen anybody else do that where they've written it and drawn it, pulled it all together, and really handled that. So part of it is just emerging from the battle unscathed.
Right.
At the same time, I look at it as something that probably did a fairly good job of accomplishing what it set out to do, which was to address some of the issues in the DC universe, streamline them, try to put them in place, fix them, make everything work a little better, and at the same time, tell a rollicking good story. I think it did all those things. And even from the story context, you know, it really did serve, just from a character standpoint, it really did serve to elevate Hal Jordan as Parallax to a whole other level, and that worked great.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it really stands the test of time. You know, I've read it like 3 times in the last week, you know, getting ready for this interview. And it's one of those things where when you read it the first time, you're like, that was good. And of course, I read it a bunch back in the day. Like I said, I read it until the covers fell off, for Christ's sakes. But like, you read it the first time and, you know, you're like, that's good. But when you read it like several times, those little subtleties, those nuances, you know, really start to stand out. You know, the desperation of Guy Gardner to, you know, save Coast City and save Hal Jordan. Like I said, the Green Arrow versus Green Lantern moment. And like we also talked about Batman disappearing, and even Power Girl having her baby amidst all this crisis. It's really, really good stuff the way that all meshed together.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate that.
No problem. And, you know, that's about all I had. You're really good at answering questions. Like, I have more questions that you actually already answered in the answers to others.
Oh, okay. Glad it worked out.
I think it's your superpower.
Yeah, if only.
One more thing before I let you go, and that is my little sister is the biggest Booster Gold fan, so I would be remiss if I didn't talk to you a little bit about Booster Gold. That is her favorite superhero, and she just wanted me to ask you a little bit about, you know, coming up with him back in the day.
Sure.
So, you know, I mean, it was such a neat, you know, when he first started, you know, he had the dollar sign and he was very, very cool as far as like trying to get licensing and stuff. And she just wanted to know, you know, I mean, how, you know, when you came up with that, was that just kind of like, I mean, cause it's an 80s thing, or was this something that you had percolated in for a long time?
Well, I'd had, the way I work is I tend to come up with loose ideas and themes first. And as from a thematic standpoint, it was a general sort of idea or impression that had been kicking around my head for quite some time. And then as the 80s came about, where we started to, I think, see the very beginning and emergence of celebrity culture, and now I don't think it's appreciated as much as it, just because it is so incredibly pervasive. But as we started to see it at that point, that took me more and more down that road, and it was something that seemed to fit together. And, you know, asking the genesis of an idea is often not the right question to ask, because ideas come from so many different places. It was more, I think, an idea that started to fit in the right place at the right time, that was of its time, and in some ways, I think, is even, if you would, more in touch with today than it would have been in touch with the times back then.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I don't disagree with you at all. Like you can read that now, and it does seem like it fits, you know, fairly into the celebrity culture that you're mentioning. Like I told you before we started, I work in TV as a master control operator, so I watch about 4 hours of Gossip magazine shows a day. This is a big, and then even on top of that, on the regular news, they cover that stuff now.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think there are a lot of ways that it could fit as an effort today.
No, I absolutely think so. One of the more underrated creations ever. Dan Juergens, thanks for taking some time to talk to us today. Hey, one more time, why don't you let everybody know what they can get grab from you off the shelves here soon?
Okay, so as I said earlier, we still have a few issues left of DC's weekly title, Futures End. That's coming out, I think the last one that came out was, say, like number 37, 38, something like that. So we still have that coming up. Still have a couple issues of Aquaman and the others left. And then in April and May, DC comes out with this big effort called Convergence. And I wrote number zero and also wrote both the Superman and Booster Gold issues that we'll be connecting as part of that, which I really think are going to be a lot of fun for people.
Awesome. I know I'm looking forward to it. I know a lot of the listeners are going to be looking forward to it. Thanks for taking some time out today, and we'd love to have you again sometime to talk about some other great stuff you did in the 90s with Superman, Sensational Spider-Man, Solar, the whole... You're the man, dude. You did it all.
I kind of did, yeah. But anytime, I'd be happy to, Dean.
Thanks so much. This has been the Unspoken Decade with Dan Juergens. I'm Dean Compton. We'll holler at you next time.